On page 33. Second verse from Deuteronomy, bottom of the page, and old font. The Egyptians did evil to us, that afflicted us and imposed hard labor upon us. Now, that first verb the word for evil in Hebrew is ra. So if I wanted to avoid the friendly translation, I just want to give it to you brutally what it means literally. See, he's a member of the CIA, so he has to be in touch all the time. No. The rest of us can turn off our phones and not get disturbed. The literal translation of Vayareyu Osanu is they eviled us. It's taking the noun evil and making it into a verb. Now, if I say it that way, they eviled us, you hear that it can be taken two ways. Either they did evil to us, or they made us evil. And indeed, there is a comment that both are true. Not only are both true, but the one depends upon the other. There's no way that an external power can have the ability to do evil to us unless we are weak, unless we are susceptible to it. So the first move is to undermine our own identity, and only then will they have the power to do evil to us. Yeah.
Someone can inflict harm on you without, like, you know, to, you know, murder you, and you might not.
So let me tell you a story about whoever it was in the Brisker lineage who was in Berlin at some point during the Second World War, and the word came out that they were looking for them, and so we saw he was together with somebody else. And he said, just meditate on the words Ein Od Melvazel. There is none other than him. And they walked up to the train station, and they bought a ticket, and they got on the train, and they traveled out, and nobody said a word to him. So, that's what it was. Also, I forget which one of the Gedolim was sent to Siberia, spent years in Siberia. He had a coat, and there was somebody else who needed a coat, and he gave it to him, and he survived 2 or 3 years in Siberia without a coat. He made up his mind that he was going to do that. And so we know enough that there has to be an internal weakness to these things, that usually, there are exceptions to everything, but usually. Okay. The Egyptians did evil to us. As it says, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And if we happen to be at war, then they join our enemies and fight against us and then leave the country. Now, the motivation here is not clear at all. What are they afraid of? What are the Egyptians afraid of?
Us to multiply.
And if we multiply, what's going to happen?
Revolt and go to war.
Revolt. And if we revolt, then what's going to happen?
They might lose.
We'll lose. And what will happen if we lose? If they lose?
Leave the country.
Leave the country. Why would they leave the country? After all, they aren't yet slaves. This was the initiation of the policy to make them into slaves.
But their goal was to get to their land, not anyone else's land.
Then they should leave whenever they want. What would be wrong with their leaving? Who needs them? They're not slaves. Yeah, when people read this verse and they forget the time sequence. If you thought you had millions of people who were slaves, you would want to lose them. But they're not slaves yet. This was the initiation of the policy to make them into slaves. So the question is, why would they want to leave the land? Number one, why would they want to leave altogether? And number two, especially if there were a war and the local powers were beaten by the Jews who played the role of the fifth column, if so, Why would they leave? They'll take over. That's why the commentators say here that Pharaoh was expressing what he feared for himself and expressed it as if the others were going to do it as a way of avoiding expressing the curse on himself. Yeah, what he's really afraid of is that he's going to be pushed out. He's going to be pushed out. Not that they're going to leave, but that he's going to be pushed out. Rather than give that verbal expression, he says, they'll leave. He really meant himself. That's what Rashi says in the verse. Okay. He afflicted us. Next page, you ready? 35. They set taskmasters over them in order to oppress them with their burdens. And they built Kisal and Ramses, the treasure cities of Sefer Pharaoh. What was the motivation of the servitude?
To break us.
Not economic. It was not economic. How do I know? Because it says, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with their burdens. That's why they did it. They wanted them to be oppressed, to break us, particularly to slow down the population increase. Later, there was an economic effect as well, but that was not the motivation for it. Yeah.
If it says here they built Pithom and Ramses as treasure cities for Pharaoh, that must have been a bit economic. So you get some people just, you know, they're building for them, they're getting something out of it.
I didn't say differently from that, but the verse tells you what the motivation was. The motivation was to oppress them with their burden. As a matter of fact, as slaves, they did build these cities. Now, Midrash here goes even further. It says something really quite shocking. That the Egyptians were more thorough, more careful, and more effective even than the Nazis. The Egyptians made women do men's work and men do women's work. Why? Because even if you're working for a hated, evil taskmaster, if you do work that you're good at, you take pride in it. I don't know if you've ever read the book To Vanquish the Dragon. It's a book about some Beis Yaakov girls, how they lived through the Holocaust. It's a terrific book. It's a heroic book. And one of the girls writes, she was an expert seamstress. So she was in working, you know, sewing garments for the German army. Of course, she had to work 7 days a week. She said, I was so good, during the week I could sew extra garments and I hid them, and on Shabbos I would pretend to work, I wasn't really working, and then when they would want to see my productivity, I would haul out one of the garments that I did during the week, and my quality was so good that no one ever asked me any questions. And you can hear in her writing that she was proud of that. So you're trying to bake somebody, you're trying to break somebody, you don't give them an opportunity for pride. The Egyptians said men will do women's work and women will do men's work, even though then they'll be bad at work and productivity will be low. Doesn't matter, because the purpose was not productivity, the purpose was to break.
Also, I don't know if the measure of somebody said after they built whatever they built, they would destroy it or would sink so that they would be demoralized, because when you doing something, you want to have a goal, you know, having a goal, you know, keeps you motivated, and then they were destroyed, so they never felt like they were accomplishing anything.
I don't know. It could be. I'm not aware of that midrash. There's a famous parable, at least in the Gittur goes back to, that God says to the person, I have a project for you. Take the saw and saw down the trees in the forest. Saw them up into logs. You're sawing and sawing and sawing. Years go by. Finally says to God, and then the trucks come and pick these logs up. Where do they go? So God says, oh, you want to know where they go? I'll show you. The truck comes and goes to the truck, and there's a roaring fire in a dump, and the truck dumps the logs into the fire and they get burned up. He says, God, what did you do to me? I'm spending years sawing these logs, these trees, and it's worthless for nothing. I didn't accomplish anything. I'm wasting my life. God said, look at your biceps and triceps. Look at your leg muscles. Measure your heart-lung capacity. Productivity wasn't out there. Productivity was in here. That's a totally different dimension. Anyway, it's just good. Then they imposed hard labor upon us, as it said, by Avidu, Mitzrayim, and Svenei Yisrael, the Korah. They subjugated us with hard labor. Now look in the Hebrew. about 8 lines down. The last word, b'farach. They made us work with farach. Farach means hard labor. Now, there is a source that says the following. Pei, resh, chaf. First, exchange the letters according to the atbash coding. Atbash means aleph is associated with tav, beis with shin, gimel with resh. In other words, it goes in from the outside. Right? So now, if you do that, pei is 6 letters from the end, so it will be exchanged with a vav. Resh is 3 letters from the end, so it will be exchanged with a gimel. Chaf is 12 letters from the end, so it will be exchanged with 12 letters in the beginning, which sort of crosses the middle line, and that is lamed. So now you have a lamed, a vav, and a gimel. Now what is the numerical value of lamed, vav, and gimel? Lamed is
30,
and vav is 6, and gimel is 3, it's 39. These are the 39 categories of malacha, of work, that the Jews were forced to perform in Egypt. You got me? It's an Akbash coding plus a gematria. Right? Where would you find that? Where would you find such an idea? Who? What source of Jewish literature would be the source for it? Huh? Yeah. Close. Right? Most people would associate it with Hasidic sources. They'd be right. They'd be right. The answer is it's a Tosfos. It's a Tosfos in the Arba Tzachos.
Where?
That last chapter of the Maram Tzachos. Right? And you think it's a Hasidic source? You're right. Tosfos is Hasidic 100%. We'll take it. We'll take it. It means that when you think about Shabbos, where these 39 categories are forbidden, you think about the Mishkan, the tabernacle, where the 39 categories were necessary to build the tabernacle, mm-hmm. You have to know that the root of it was in what the Egyptians made us do as slave labor. Now you can make a whole thing. You can make a whole thing. Like Rosh Baruch Hu said, Abadayim, they're my slaves. Right? The condition of slavery is not unnatural for the Jewish people. It's a question of who you're a slave of. And Rambam says, why do we call Shabbos Zechel Yetzias Mitzrayim and remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt? What has Shabbos got to do with the Exodus from Egypt? Okay, Jewish history quiz time. On what day of the week did the Jews leave Egypt?
Friday.
Okay, it's either Friday or
Sunday.
You just guessed. It's either Friday or Thursday, depending on whether it was 50 or 51 days from the Exodus to Shavuos. Shavuos was on Shabbos. So what has the Exodus got to do? What has Shabbos got to do with the Exodus? The Rambam asked this question more in the Bukhin, and the guy is perplexed, and he says, the fact that you can stop work shows that you're not a slave. You have to ask yourself, why am I not a slave? I'm not a slave because God took us out of Egypt. So the very fact that you stop malacha, which is a better translation than work, the very fact that you stop malacha shows it's testimony to the fact that God took you out of Egypt. So the work in Egypt becomes the root of how we serve God, and the root of Shabbat all goes back to the 39 in Egypt. That's part of what Tosfos is saying. Okay. We cried out to Hashem, the God of our fathers, and Hashem heard our cry and saw our affliction, our burden, and our oppression. Watch. We cried out to Hashem, the God of our fathers. That's the verse from Deuteronomy. As it says, quoting from Exodus, it happened in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, the children of Israel groaned because of the servitude and cried. Their cry, because of the servitude, rose up to God. What made them cry? Servitude. Says twice in the same verse. The verse is emphasizing this. They cry because of the servitude. Let me tell you what the Gaon of Vilna says. The Gaon of Vilna says something extremely fundamental here. If you look throughout the book of Exodus, when God says, "Why did the Jews out?" Why he's taking the Jews out. Two reasons are given. Number one, I promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And number two, they will serve me on the mountain and receive the Torah. no merit, no merit on their part is ever cited as a reason for taking them out. It's not that they deserved it, they didn't earn it. It was a promise to the patriarchs and something for the future. Says the Gaon of Vilna, the fact that God promised the patriarchs does not by itself mean that they're going to get to go out. I said I promised the patriarchs, that's true, but that's not enough of an explanation. After all, according to the Midrash, 80% died. 80% died in the 3 days of darkness. And God, so to speak, threatened, I mean, that requires its own analysis, after the golden calf and after the sin of the spies, to wipe them all out and to make a new nation out of Moses. So the fact that God promised the patriarchs is no guarantee that these people are going to be saved. I'm putting the gold point in our terminology. The point is this: the people have to be relevant to the patriarchs. They have to represent the patriarchs. They have to be a continuation of the patriarchs. Only then will the promise of the patriarchs apply to them. Otherwise, you know, you sort of look through the world at the world through the patriarch lens. Who do you see? The 80% were invisible to the patriarch lens. That's why they were lost to Egypt. Okay, so now how are you going to be relevant? You have to at least pray to God to get you out. You may not deserve it, but you have to recognize that God's running the world and ask Him. But they weren't praying to God to get out. So says the Gaon, God, with divine providence, caused the servitude to become so overwhelmingly difficult and bitter that the servitude forced them to cry out. Okay, it forced them, but they did cry out. And once they cried out, then that made them relevant to the promise of the patriarchs, and then the promise of the patriarchs could be the reason for taking them out. But the promise of the patriarchs alone is not enough of an explanation, because as I told you, people who were biological descendants of the patriarchs didn't make it.
Didn't they cry because the king of Egypt that was previous was good to the Jews, and that I don't understand why, like, we're talking about all these hard labors when the first king of Egypt was good to the Jews.
How long were they in Egypt? 210 years. 190 was subtracted from 400. Isn't that enough time for there to be several kings? Good ones, bad ones, right? Conditions could change.
But we only know of two, no?
Why?
No, the first king that was good to at the time of Yosef, mm-hmm. and then after that the one we speak about all throughout the other.
I don't know why you have to assume that. There's a Paro when Moses is born, and there's a Paro when they leave 80 years later. Who says the same Paro? Paro, by the way, is a title for the king. It's not his name. You know, George Paro, Paro Smith. It's not his name. It's a title of it, so it's a king. Doesn't have to be the same person. Okay.
Did you just know that 80% didn't die when you went to service? You know what?
Or they did, and other things prevented it. There was something that made them not. You're right to use that. Yes, I have to say something like that. Or, well, okay. Since you asked it. There's a little bit of an ambiguity here, which always bothers me. If you look at the verse in Exodus, it does not say they cried out to Hashem. Verse in Deuteronomy says they cried out to Hashem. Verse in Exodus says they cried out, groaned and cried. And the cry, because of their servitude, rose up to God. That sounds almost as if it was accidental. They're crying out and their cry rose. Not that they directed the cry to God, but the verse in Deuteronomy does say that. We cried out to Hashem. So I used to say, the verse in Deuteronomy, you have four verses to encapsulate 20 chapters of the book of Exodus. Okay, you know, it's a very short summary. Maybe it wasn't emphasizing that particular part, detail. But now, given your question, Maybe that's the way to look at it. It was a mixed bag. Some people did, some people didn't. And what Deuteronomy is emphasizing is the fact that there were the people who did, and those were the people who were taken out. Exodus is telling the story in context. It says there was a cry. And if I take it from what you said, that means 80% didn't cry out to God. They cried out because of the pain of the servitude. That's the vast majority. So the Torah simply says there was a cry. There were some who cried out to God, but they were a minority. Right? The Torah could rely on the assumption today, of course, it's a very fragile, unjustified assumption, but the Torah would rely on the assumption that the reader of Exodus would also read Deuteronomy and figure out that they were related. Not always been just that. Okay. Hashem heard our cry. As it says, Hashem heard their groaning, remembered covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There you are, black and white. Right? Now, just to rehearse something which I've told you several times. He remembered it? You mean in the interim he forgot it? What does Lizkor mean in biblical Hebrew?
Remember.
No. Pay attention.
He's brought back to his attention.
Well, that sounds like it was out of his attention. Come on, you better than that. Huh? You gotta avoid remember. Remember implies that he forgot. We have to avoid that implication. How do you explain the word this core so it doesn't have any implication to forget?
Where right now they might not deserve it, this has taken them above and beyond where there's compassion.
Now you're trying to get in context. Give me a general definition of this core. greatly disappointed. Be compelled. We're talking about God now. Nothing compels God.
To recount?
To make a present decision on the basis of a past fact.
Okay.
Inscribe that in your on your bone. To make a present decision on the basis of a past fact. Going to the end of this month, I can tell. Right? Not that you forgot in between. That past fact wasn't relevant to the decisions you're making now. Now it is relevant. When's the last time that you thought about the fact that 33 and 55 is 88? It's probably years and years and years, right? Right? I wouldn't say that you forgot in the interim. You didn't forget that 33 and 55 is 88. You just had no use for it. So it sat there in your memory banks until, you know, in the ROM, not in the RAM, right? Okay. So here, it means now. Covenant they made with the patriarch now became the basis for the decision to take them out. He saw our affliction. This is the disruption of family life. And it says, Hashem saw, Hashem knew, something that only Hashem could see and know. Yes, Amalenu. And burden, I'm not sure about that translation. These are the children. As it says, all the males should be thrown into the river. Here, there's a quite an important use of the word amal in Hebrew connotes efforts without results. Efforts that don't pay off. There's a famous expression that you say when you finish your masechta, tractate of the Talmud and celebrate. Ano melem heim melem. Ano melem chab nischar, heim melem heim chab nischar. We strive and they strive, meaning people not involved in learning Torah. We strive and receive a reward, they strive and don't receive a reward. So the Rabbi Chaim said, you are studying the Torah and he's a shoemaker. Okay, you're striving, you'll receive a reward. He's a shoemaker. Won't he receive a reward? He gets paid for making shoes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it says the Chofetz Chaim, you know, in those days, you didn't walk into the shoe store which has in stock 500 pairs of shoes to pick one you like. They measured your foot and they made your shoes to fit. What happens if they measure your shoe and then he makes the shoe and you come in and try it on, it doesn't fit? Then he doesn't get paid. Now, Amal Amelim, Hema Amelim. Amal means effort without results. Good. he cut the leather and made the hole and sewed it up, and it doesn't fit. So he worked without result, and he doesn't get paid. What would be the parallel case in Torah? You're sitting and learning a Tosfos, beating your head against the Tosfos, you turn it upside down, inside out, you chew it up, and nothing helps. It just doesn't go. And you end up with a big question mark on that page. I don't get it. So it's learning without results. Will you be rewarded for it? Yes, you will. Because in Torah, you're rewarded for the effort, not for the results. What's the deep reason why you're not rewarded for the results? Because the results are a gift. You didn't make them. The results themselves are only a gift. All you have in your power is the effort. And you're rewarded for what you did, not for the gift that you got. Okay. That's Amal. That's it says, the children, you go to the effort and the trouble of creating a pregnancy, and then the child is born, and the funnel from the child is thrown in the river, that's Amal. Lachatz means oppression in the literal sense of the word. It means pressing on you. Pressure. And there the verse says the exact same thing. You see the pressure that they put on. Okay. Hashem took us out of Egypt with a strong hand and an outstretched arm, great awe, the signs of wonders. Now, let's see how to read this. God took us out with a strong hand. What could that possibly mean? What would it mean to say that God used a strong hand? What does strength mean vis-a-vis God? We're talking about the creator of the universe, the all-powerful creator of the universe. What could it possibly mean to talk about a strong hand?
Change of nature.
Oh. You're two steps ahead of me, but I think let's go step by step. But that, I think Remy belt is the correct answer, because you have an unfair advantage. You're wearing a black belt with kippah, so you know, mm-hmm. you know things like this. And these guys are just learning it. To say that strength was used implies that there was. Huh? Okay, there was effort. Now, and to say that effort was used implies that there was. What?
His will.
Yes, but what else does it imply?
Direct action.
Suppose I said it was done without strength. We're still done. We're done without strength. With a weak hand. We're done. Wouldn't that imply will? Wouldn't that imply direct action? So what do I add when I say that it was done with strength? What else must there be in the picture if strength was used?
Did it with his heart?
Miracles?
Resistance! You're all to use strength against resistance.
What kind of resistance could it be against what I mean?
Good. Step by step. Step by step. We'll get there. But don't abandon your logic in the face of piety. Right? Press your logic all the way, and if piety shows you made a mistake, you say, okay, my logic is this far. I know I made a mistake, something's wrong. Just don't abandon your logic, you know. Don't. It's not our religion, you know. There are other religions like that, where you meditate at the sound of one hand clapping, getting a break. Our goal is not to blow our minds. Our goal is to use our minds. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes we run up against a brick wall. But don't abandon your mind. So to say that there is strength used means there's resistance. Okay, now he asks quite rightly, resistance against the creator of the universe? That's ridiculous. Okay, so then what must you conclude? Where is the resistance located? Against the creator of the universe?
I don't know.
Well, think outside the box, as my wife would say.
Himself?
Yes, the resistance has to be internal. Couldn't be an external resistance to the creator of the universe, so it has to be internal. The picture has to be here of a struggle within God. Now let me enforce this for you. In Pirkei Avos, it says, Ezehu Gibor, who is mighty? Anybody know the end of it? A covetous Israel. A person who conquers his own spirit. That's what Gibor means. Gibor means a person who conquers his own spirit. No, isn't God called Gibor? Well, for those who don't know, yes, he is. All over the place. All the time. No, and Chazal are defining this concept for us. They tell you Gibor means he conquers his own spirit. Conquering his own spirit pictures a person at war with himself. More strictly speaking, part of him is at war with another part of him. Right? If God is called Gibor, then we have to picture internal conflicts within God. Yes. How can you picture internal conflict within God? Here's how you do it. All Jewish philosophy is based on this. All we know about God is his will. We don't know anything more about God than his will and his actions. Actions now being an expression of will. And will is built on purpose. You do something for a purpose. And we know something about God's purposes. And God's purposes can come into conflict with one another. And then one purpose wins and the other purpose loses. You have the exact same model. The exact same model. So, when God sustains people who don't deserve it, and the principle of strict justice says, but they don't deserve it, they should be wiped out. As the Ramchal says in part 2, chapter 8 of the Derech Hashem, the way of God, loving kindness, which is running the world from the top, says to justice, too bad. We're not doing justice now. I'm holding you back. I'm not going to allow you to express yourself. Either to modify and weaken justice or to overlook justice altogether. Just to overwhelm justice. Say, no, we're not doing that. And that's an internal conflict. And on the other hand, when justice asserts itself, loving kindness has to be held back because loving kindness would not allow any withholding, not any restriction, not any loss. So since these principles are set up in conflict with one another, there's going to be internal conflict and there's going to be struggle and there's going to be times when one overtakes the other. And here, given what I have already told you, let's see if you can finish it. What is the outstretched hand, the strong hand? What is the strong hand? And what is the resistance? And who's overcoming who?
The strong hand is mercy and the weak hand is justice. Mercy overcoming justice.
That's right, because over here the Jewish people didn't deserve it. They didn't deserve it, they had no merit, they had no accomplishments, and God saved them anyhow. And justice said, no, you can't do that. And I have quoted the Midrashim to you. The angel said, these serve for idols and those serve for idols. Why are you punishing these and saving those? That was this expression of justice. What do you mean? There isn't a significant difference between the two groups. Why are you favoring one and destroying the other? So this is the attribute of exactly mercy, but whatever it is on that side of the fence, which is withholding justice and overcoming strength. I told you, some of you at least in another context, strength always refers to loving kindness. Strength always runs to loving kindness. Yigdal nachoach Hashem, let God's strength be great. Rashi says it's talking about Chesed. So the picture here is literally correct. Strong means there's resistance and it's being overcome because there was a complaint that the Jews didn't deserve to be taken out of Egypt. Yeah.
I was under the impression that all the Jews that had sinned were killed out, like in Koshet.
There's a difference between those who... Oh, I'm sorry. Let me say it another way. You're right to ask. Let me say it the other way. Mercy requires a justification. Mercy always requires a justification because mercy says, don't do justice. Mercy is always an uphill battle. Don't do justice. The question will be, why not? It is justice, you know. Why shouldn't we do justice? You have a reason for that. You can't just say no. Right? Kindness doesn't need a reason. You have to justify being kind. But if you're going to say no to justice, you have to have a reason. Now, that means that mercy can run out. Mercy can run out. Because there has to be a reason. And the reason can come to a point where it runs out. So this is the idea here, that the 80% were beyond mercy. The 20% were candidates for mercy. Nobody deserved it. Nobody. I don't know. Maybe Aaron deserved it, or maybe the Levites, but the vast majority didn't deserve it. You know what it's like? It's like anyway, that's the idea, yeah.
isn't for something to be a conflict, a true conflict, don't you not, you can't know what the end result's going to be. I feel no. like if you know what the result's going to be, then it's not really a conflict.
You never did competitive sports, did you?
What?
You never did one-on-one sports, did you?
I have.
What? Even if you know you're going to win, it's not a conflict? Yes, it is. Come on. I did enough competitive sports. I know that you can go, I knew it was going to win. It's still a conflict. Of course it's a conflict. Yeah.
This idea of like internal conflict within Hashem, like the Ramchal also in the beginning says that, you know, God is one, there's no division. So we're supposed to understand this from our level, to be able to,
that's
understand the process.
It's two different levels.
But in the end, there's no actual.
How do you, in the end?
I mean,
They're both real. There's a higher level, which is all one, and there's a lower level, which divides up. Or at least divides up the way we perceive it. That doesn't mean it's not real. We spoke about this once. You know, if you take a glass and fill it half with water and put a knife in it, from almost every angle where you, if you look at it at the surface of the water, the knife will look down. Right? So we say, well, okay, don't make a mistake. It's not really bent. Really, it's straight. It just looks bent. Right? That way of talking misses out on an important fact. Imagine you're standing here. I'm standing here. I'm looking at the glass. And I see at the surface it goes like this. Right? Somebody's standing right next to me, and he looks at the glass. He says, I don't know what you're talking about. To me, it looks perfectly straight. He has a problem! Because it really, now notice the vocabulary, it really looks bent, doesn't it? That's the way it really looks. And if he doesn't see that, then there's something wrong with his glasses, something wrong with his eyes, something wrong with his brain. He has a serious problem, because it really looks bent. The moral of the story is that there are two types of realities. There's an independent reality, and there's a relational reality. They're both real. They're both real. It's just that one is the way the knife is if nobody's looking. And the other is the way the knife appears when you're looking. But both are real. Neither one is a mistake. If you make the mistake of projecting, that's the way it looks, so that's the way it is when no one's looking, that could be a mistake. But if you focus on the way it looks, that's not a mistake. So the way God reveals himself to us is the way he really reveals himself to us. And in the context of his relationship to us, that's what he really is. Of course, above and beyond the way he looks to us, there's another reality, which is more fundamental, right? But that doesn't mean the way he appears to us isn't real. It's the real appearance that he shows us. Okay? All right, anyway. This is all we can describe, the appearance. We talk about internal conflict, we talk about within the appearance. Okay, Hashem brought us out of Egypt, not through an angel. Not through a seraph, not through a messenger. The Holy One blessed be in his glory himself, as it says, I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night. I will slay all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, the man and the beast. And upon all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments, I, Hashem. I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, I, no angel. Let me say that literally, because it might lead to a wrong implication. I am not an angel. I will slay the firstborn in the land of Egypt. I am not the seraph. I told the God against Egypt, I will execute judgments. I am not a messenger. I am Hashem. It is I and is and no other. Now I want to tell you something very surprising here. Very surprising. And then show you how sometimes the translation has to be looked at with considerable salt. The Torah says that how do you translate Pesach? Hashem Pesach al Batein. Say again, Passover. You see the alliteration. Hey, T, Passover, Pesach. Well, not so easy. It's not so easy.
when Moses is telling the people what's going to happen, so like this, put the blood on the doorpost and the mitzvah zozos. No one leave his house till the morning. Hashem will pass through to plague Egypt, and he will see the blood on the lintel on his two mezuzos. Upasach Hashem al hapesach, Hashem will pasach on the entrance. Could al mean over? Yeah, could mean over, could mean on. And he will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to plague. Believe him, amashkis lavo abatechem go. He will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to plague. Who is this destroyer? We're in a whole context now. Didn't we just finish reading, I am not a malach, I am not a seraph, I am not a shaliach? Right? Taking that into account, we have a problem here. I'm not just looking for a candidate. I'm trying to make sense of what it says over there. Right? Now, also, how can Hashem prevent the destroyer from coming into my house by passing over my entrance? How is that going to prevent the destroyer from coming in? So Rashi says the meaning here is quite different. Pasach al means he jumped from entrance to entrance. Pasach means to jump onto, not to pass over. As it says in Navi, Poseach Ashtei Se'ifim, a person who's hesitating between two ideas, it's like he has a foot on this stump and a foot on this stump, and he jumps from stump to stump. He can't make up his mind where to stand. Right? Poseach al Shtei Se'ifim, he's jumping on both of them, from one to the other. So Poseach, he doesn't mean passing over the houses, it means passing from house to house. The picture here is that there is a destroyer in the streets, let loose in the streets, destroying. And the Rav says about, I won't let him come into your houses. As he goes from street to street, I'll follow him, or I'll go with him, so to speak. And when he comes to a Jewish house, I'll stand on the doorway and I won't let him come in. Comes to the Egyptian house, I'll let him go in. The Ramban says that's exactly what happened here. It's exactly what happened here. But his brother did not kill the Egyptian firstborn. He was protecting the Jewish firstborn. The Mashkis, the destroyer, was destroying the Jewish firstborn. The Egyptian firstborn. Now, what does it say here? Don't go outside. Because the destroyer is loose in the streets. And he, Gemara says, he which did the Roshus the Mashkis, the Ashkis, Shuv ain't a Lachim in Tarek the Roshus. When the Mashkis, the same word, Gemara is using the same word as in this verse, when the destroyer is given permission to destroy, the destroyer doesn't distinguish between the good and the evil, between the righteous and the wicked. He doesn't distinguish. So God says, listen, the way this is going to happen is the destroyer is going to roam around. And he's going to destroy those houses that have the blood on them. Those Jews that stay in those houses will be protected. How will they be protected? Because I'll see the blood and I'll stand there and I'll protect them. If a Jew's out in the street, he's lost. He's not associated with the blood in the house, and he'll be killed by the destroyer. Says the Ramban, because when a king travels, he travels with a retinue. He doesn't travel alone. He travels with a whole assembled company. And one of the jobs of the company is to demand honor for the king. The honor of the king. And here, where you had the Egyptians, so they're being struck down by this retinue. So now, if that's the Ramban's picture, and that's in a sense Rashi's picture, and the verse really pretty clearly says it, what then is the Haggadah saying? That is, I. Okay. I will pass through the land of Egypt and die. I know angel. I will slay the third of Egypt. I know Sarah. Upon all of God's evil, I will say, I know messengers. I am Shem, it is I and no other. What could that possibly mean, given the picture that I have just described to you? There is a logical way out. Almost everything that happens in the world happens via some kind of intermediary alone. God sends the intermediary to do it alone. God sits at the top of the causal chain, so to speak. Okay, in another sense, he's present at every link of the causal chain. I know there are distinctions here. That's in Hashem. Okay, I'm saying this for the tapes. We know that. But usually, where he manifests himself is at the top of the chain, and his will is carried out at the lowest level by an angel. What you can say, from the point of view of the Ramban and the Pesach, the way it's written, and the Rashi, is that what he means here is, I'm not going to give this over to an intermediary. I'm not going to just send an intermediary. I'm coming myself. Will I be the one who pulls the trigger? No, not necessarily, but I'll be there. I'm there personally to direct it. Not sitting on high, sending messengers or intermediaries to do it. If you're not going to do it, you're going to do it. The action will be carried out through intermediaries. What's the importance of your being there? There are several things to say. One of them, yeah, you know. One of them is, when Moses says to Pharaoh, Pharaoh says, pray for me. Moses says, when I leave the city, I'll pray for you. Why? Because the city was filled with idol worship. Moses says, I can't pray to God in the city that's filled with idol worship. Okay, so the idol worship is a barrier to praying to God. Is it a barrier to God? The answer is, there are no barriers to God. Nothing is a barrier to God. No matter what the forces are there, he wants to be there, he can be there. So God said, listen, I know you didn't pray for me there, and it was right, you shouldn't pray for me there, right? Because under normal channels, it's not going to work that way. But when I want it to happen, I make it happen myself. And with my holiness, as the Haggadah calls it here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He. He went, and He did it. Of course, with His retinue, and this one carried out this function, that one carried out that function, but He was there personally and did it. It wasn't done through an intermediary with Him absent from the event. Yeah.
The passage, and upon all the gods of Egypt, they'll execute judgment, is that talking about the idols then?
Yes. Now, yes, I don't know what happened that night, unless they say, they left at daybreak. Now, let's figure this out. What is the date in which they left? The Hebrew monthly date? 15th of Nisan. What's unique about the 15th of Nisan? Full moon. Full moon means that there is a time when the sun and the moon are both visible. Indeed, in the morning after the full moon, the morning, you know, that since the moon is falling further behind the sun, so you will have some minutes in which both the sun and the moon are both visible. Right? And that's what the Midrash says, that they went out at that moment, so no one could say, ha, you went out in the daytime because you were afraid of the moon god. Or, ha, you went out at night because you were afraid of the sun god. No, the sun was there, the moon was there, they were both visible, and we walked out in full sight of both of them, and nothing could stop us. Right? Maybe that's what it means, or there's something else that I'm just not aware of. Okay? Alright. Pick it up tomorrow.
Thank you very much.